We'll continue these conversations more within the work within the panelist session. So let's get started. We have more words of wisdom here that need to be expressed. Everyone, let's please sit down. Thank you. And I don't know. Okay, Michael, did you have? Okay. What? That's already out. Yeah, Bill is first. Bill, you don't have a briefing. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so we'll start the second part of this, and you know, obviously, the format will be the same. Informal discussion after the individual panelists have roughly about 10 minutes to present whatever their thoughts are, and then conversation. So, Bill Anderson, Bill.
So I debated whether I wanted to do slides or something like that, and I really didn't know what I wanted to say, so I'm glad I waited and I wrote up some notes. And contrary to what I usually talk about something having to do with logic or common logic or something, and I'm not going to do that today. So this bit of a talk that I have is really more tailored towards Mills than anybody else. Mills should enjoy this, because I'm going to really talk about sort of the trajectory that our business has followed, and I think it'll spur some discussion. So right now I work for HighFleet. We used to be called Ontology Works. And what I wanted to center the talk around is, why did we change the name? I'll get to that at the end. So the company started in 1998. So barring, unless you want to count PsyCorp as a semantic technology company, I think we've probably been in business longer than any semantic technology company. The comments of Ralph Hodgson last week notwithstanding. So I think he said he was first, so we were 2 years before them. So, and it really kicked off with this Heidelberg conference. And at the Heidelberg conference in 98 and after that, I met guys like Nicola and Barry and Michael and Chris Menzel. And I want to say that they caused some serious mental illness in my mind. No, seriously, I mean, I think they showed me what this formal ontology business was all about. And so we really kind of pursued a dual track originally with Ontology Works. One was the application of these concepts of formal ontology to building ontologies in the other sense of the word that were in a sense defensible, right? Why is it this way as opposed to that way? The other track we went down, and this was the time at 98, 99, 2000 when the semantic web thing was spinning up, we also went down the track that we decided not to go the web route. We decided that we weren't interested, not that we didn't think it was interesting, it's just that we as a company decided that we were not interested in pursuing the integration of arbitrarily developed information resources on the web. So we decided to focus on enterprise problems, of which there were plenty. Running a business, you pick an area where you think you might make some money, right? And we thought we'd make money quicker addressing enterprise problems than some kind of longer-term web vision. So initially, a number of us came from the Intel community. We were a combination in various local universities, including University of Maryland, where I worked for Jim Hendler. UMBC, places like that, but all of us had NSA backgrounds. And so we were well acquainted with the kind of problems, and they've got them, believe me, to which these technologies are appropriate to be applied. So we had a stock of problems in our head, ranging from analytic problems to integration problems, to just sort of data organization problems in general, model management kind of things. So we had that in mind, and we decided to go forward with this enterprise focus. So we kind of entered, we started this too early. We were pretty naive, I think, in 1998, thinking that we're actually going to make money off of this. And we didn't for a long time. It was really, really hard. I mean, we were eating a lot of Top Ramen and you know, a lot of late payments and a lot of collection calls and stuff like that. The darkest time was probably 2003. For some reason or other, you know, we were nearing the end of our finances. The message had not yet spread, and we do thank the Semantic Web community for sort of spreading the message to some extent. And that was the time when the Army had given me my all-expense-paid vacation to Central Asia. So it was a little bit hard for the company. But after that, things picked up. So ever since then, things have been pretty good. So where has our company been working in that time? We're working social network analysis, some biosurveillance work, an interesting project, I thought, in fault detection and prediction for cable TV networks. So it was interesting stuff. And notice none of this really required this sort of uber, you know, web view of, you know, where everything's got to be turned into URIs. There's plenty of great problems out there without having to do that, right? There's a lot of problems out there. And if you want to talk in terms of market size, I mean, Mills could probably quote you what he thinks the market size is. He probably got a better number than anybody. But just addressing enterprise problems without worrying about the web, I mean, it's untapped tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, right? So there's plenty of work to be done. So that was kind of the business side. I'll take a quick diversion into the technical side, and then I'll go back to business. So on the technical side, we had some big problems that came up. Even though we had initially decided to focus on the enterprise, query answering performance became a big problem for our customers. We simply couldn't operate at the kind of data scales that they had. And I think the triple stores these days are in the ballpark, right? You know, you have billions of, I won't use the word triple because there are other things out there other than triples, billions of assertions, right? That's about right. You have to operate at those kind of scales. So the answer was that we changed our technology around from one that Leo was familiar with our early days that was based in a logic programming system called XSB to building our own engine. And we were kind of forced into that, which was a parallel, concurrent, transactional, scalable engine in which so far we've put about 70 person years of effort. So in case you're thinking of building your own such engines, they take a long time to build, and they're very expensive. But sometimes it can be worth it. The other challenge that we face is one of standardization. So we kind of built our own thing. We were heavily influenced by a number of directions, mostly Stanford's KIF, but also by the Psych project, and I had done some work as a grad student with Psych. So we kind of built our own language, much like the Psych guys did, you know, to do what we needed to do. And still to this day, even though we've come towards the common logic standard, we have some idiosyncratic things in there. Why is this? Well, it's for the same reason that Sparkle, for example, has aggregation operators in it. Notice they're not in OWL, but they're in Sparkle, and everyone uses them. The reason is, for building real applications, you got to have them. Right? Those aren't things that fit well in classical logical semantics, but you've got to have them in your languages. You've got to have ways of dealing with concrete data types and so on. Logical languages do a real bad job of that. Not necessarily, but as an engineering practical matter, they don't do well. So at that time, the common logic effort was getting going. We decided, okay, we're going to ride that train. So we did. We started swerving our language more and more closer away from KIF, more towards CLIF, the KIF-looking concrete dialect of common logic. And so that took us some time. And so we developed this new language, which is called eCLIF, or extended CLIF. It's basically CLIF with these database operators extended in it. So at the same time, the W3C stuff's gaining a lot of traction. This is like mid-2000s now, right? So we have to keep our eye on that. We knew we'd have to work with it, and we designed our stuff to work with it, but we weren't yet working with it. If we were, it was by ETL processes. So we'd bulk translate a bunch of RDF into something that, you know, it's shove it into common logic, bulk translate OWL theories into some form of common logic that we could actually process. But some of the more interesting and the biggest problems that came up during this time in dealing with these real customer projects were sort of three issues which I think are going to end up being, I guess, the elephant in the room, right, for ontology. And I think the three issues are this. I think they're ontology management, access control, and provenance. I haven't heard them mentioned, and I hardly ever hear them mentioned in these talks. In almost every environment in which we operate, in government intelligence naturally, especially, but in pharmaceutical law enforcement, even I was talking to someone who's doing retail, right? The requirements are there to handle that and to provide a principled handling of it. I mean, there's been a lot of retrofitted hacks and so on, and college, you know, university papers and so on that have been done on it, but a principled model that simultaneously does what we want in terms of semantics and does what we need in terms of real application performance, in terms of access control and provenance, and also ontology management, to at least the sort of level of quality we expect when we do code management, is just not there now. It's really an unsolved problem. This has been the subject of my research for the last 4 years at HighFleet, which is what I do. My job is to make the new stuff. And then we have engineers that actually make it work. So I think that in particular, the project that Dennis was describing earlier, these are going to become issues that will have to be faced probably in the near future, especially for government applications. So now I'm kind of the punchline of my little spiel. So why the name change? Why did we take the word ontology out of the name of our company? I fought this, by the way. I didn't like the idea. It's since grown on me. It happened about a year ago. The idea of it happened 18 months ago. The actual name change happened a year ago and became official. What we noticed in our customer interactions, as I gave you a sample of the kind of companies we're dealing with, the kind of entities we're dealing with, and I'm not talking about academic institutions, I'm not talking about companies that primarily do research, I'm talking about people out there who have actual IT budgets and they sell, you know, soap instead of papers. So we noticed this word becoming increasingly radioactive, right? We would say it and we get funny looks. We'd say it and we find ourselves in strange conversations we didn't want to be in. So there were a number of points. So there was significant confusion over the meaning of the word. The thesis that ontology is equal to those things which are expressible in RDFS or OWL had since gained considerable traction in people's minds. They couldn't separate the two concepts apart from each other. So with some groups, not many, very few actually, we got, well, you're not doing OWL, but you're doing ontology. I don't understand. Right, so we got a lot of that. But more of the other things, which I'll explain in a second. There was also, and I think most seriously, there was this perception of sort of widespread perception of unkept promises by various tool vendors and also large government integrators that came in, not just government integrators, people that came into private companies as well and said, we're going to give you ontology, right, and it's going to solve all your problems. Ultimately, every such project we ran across had failed, and we were talking to the people that were in charge of signing the checks for the people that made the promises that failed. And so we had a pretty tough time talking to these people, as you can imagine. It's a difficult crowd to make a pitch to. The other thing, a more minor point that we got to, we'd get into arguments with people. There's a lot of people out there with BAs in philosophy, right? And so, Nicola, for example, sort of coming from this Aristotelian school and other schools, would quickly recognize what I think is ontology is what he thinks is ontology. But there's a lot of people that don't think that, right? And so you end up in arguments with them, and that's counterproductive because they work there, and as soon as you leave, they're going to go whisper in the boss's ear, and you've lost the sale. So. And the other thing which I found was really an interesting effect, I don't mean to drone on about this stuff, I figure at least Mills will be interested, if not anybody else, right? So there's a lot of executives out there, you'll go start talking about this ontology stuff and the wonderful things it'll do, but they've never heard the word before coming into the meeting. They've never run into it at all, right? But you know the way people are, and they're high-powered, you know, executives, they don't want to admit ignorance, right? So they'll just sit there. And then afterwards, they'll get really mad because you started using this word that they didn't know, right? And even though you did your best to explain it to them, you know, one quick business meeting isn't enough. So that, and the final thing, the killer thing for us was the focus on really, we were worried about what problems did the customer have to solve, right? What was it that they were under so much pain that they're considering not using Oracle, right, to solve it, right? They actually called us up. They you know they're really hurting if they're going to drop Oracle and stuff. So we decided to focus on solutions, and so we picked a nonsensical name for the company. It's actually kind of sensical because there's some Zeppelin imagery on our website and all that. But it makes sense in a way. But we tried to find nonsensical names. We just couldn't find them. You know, they were all the small domains were all used up, so we just picked one. But it's suggestive of nothing. We wanted to go in there and talk about solutions that would actually help people. So just to finish up, I'll talk about what we're doing today and in the near future. So we're still in the IC. So I was here, I was told to talk about, I don't have my glasses on, real world use of ontologies. So we have four operational projects in the IC, stuff running on operational data, some of it running 24/7 at real rates, at real data sizes. We're pretty proud of that. We put a lot of work into it. And we have some amount of service engagement, but that's the cool thing. We don't have that much service engagement. Software runs and it does what it does. We're not a body shop. We build software products and we sell them and we give enough training to keep the stuff going. And that's the idea. So we had the IC work. We have some analytical apps in pharma. This is pretty exciting. It's new stuff. Can't say anything more. Can't say who the customers are. Sorry about that. Some new work in clinical trial management. And finally, with a Canadian partner, pretty exciting business intelligence coupled with semantic integration of heterogeneous data sources. Just to finish up here, in the future, we've decided to take on the semantic integration problem and to productize our stuff. It's currently not productized. It's a loose suite of tools, and we've decided to productize it, but we don't know when. And we've decided to take on this meta-level issue head-on, the one I discussed before, the business of ontology management, about having a logic that's sufficiently powerful to treat these ontologies as objects, so we can talk about their change, we can talk about who edited them, we can talk about what makes one different from another. Fortunately, it's the same machinery that lets you do multi-level access control and provenance over the data. It's one of the advantages we have in not being constrained to work with the existing W3C standards. The use of common logic has proved to be enormously flexible, enormously powerful in doing this. We're still doing things that are within the common logic standard, but it's things that we could not do and stay within the standards set down by the W3C. Finally, so that brings me to W3C. So our position has been, and it remains, and we're actually putting it into code now, that we, and those of you who heard the line last week, please forgive me, over at Allion, that we work with the W3C and not for them. We are more than happy to ingest all the RDF data people will give us. RDF is trivially expressible in common logic via translation. We're more than happy to ingest most of the logic. We can't do everything because we have a logic programming-based system at HighFleet, even though Common Logic can. Common Logic can capture all of L. We have a logic programming-based system. We can't compute everything that L will compute, but we can compute all of the query answering profiles that were referred to before. So those turn out to be, at query answering time, when you actually want to get stuff done with your data, those are the things that people are most interested in using. We'll defer to the OWL reasoners and so on for doing offline reconciliation of ontologies. So that's the end of my comments.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Yep.
John?
Oh, no.
Well, there's a lot of things I could say, but one thing that I do want to say is that I'm very happy to hear that you're using a version of CLIF and ECLIF, extended CLIF. I think those extensions we could put into the standard because we're talking about a new standard, a new revised standard for the future, and let's talk about that because we would like, I would very much like to put them in.
Some of them are extra logical, which is why I haven't pushed them with the aggregation operators, for example.
Okay.
They're not expressible within those semantics.
Okay. I think one thing that we will have to do is talk about that.
Yep.
Because one of the persons who is very strict and pure is Pat Hayes. And I would like to loosen Pat a bit so that he could accept a few more things. Because there's a lot of things that people would like to have, and I think they could be put in within a formally defined semantics that would be compatible with CL. So we might talk about that.
There was an example of that Pat gave me. He couldn't understand why we had a special syntax to demarcate which were the variables and which were the names. As you know, in common logic, you don't need that.
Right.
And I said, well, if you want to tell the system what variables you want to extract bindings for the answers, you have to have it.
Well,
so yeah, there's some compromise. If you're going to make a language that acts as an interface to a database, there's things you have to do.
Well, there's common logic semantics, and then there's the dialects, because I defined the CGIF dialects for conceptual graphs, and I did make that distinction. I put question marks in front of the variables for very much the same kind of reason. No, it doesn't work. Oh, it does work.
I'd like to clarify for maybe the audience, what's the status of getting something like Common Logic through W3?
It's an ISO standard.
ISO is not W3.
ISO
trumps W3. Yeah, but does W3 recognize that?
Excuse me. Can I? Can I add something about that because I'm one of the authors of the DoD policy for that? That's correct. However, that is changing, and we are now recognizing W3C and OASIS standards as being approximately equal to an ISO accredited standard.
And offhand, I would say that it's difficult to get W3C to address this because, in a sense, they have competing standards.
Did you say OASIS too?
Yes.
Pat? Microphone.
Thanks. I think it's broken. I don't know if there's any point in trying to retrieve it. That sounds like a sort of a French project to me.
No. Aaron in the back first, and then Michael Ushold.
Hi, this is addressed for the DoD policy. It would worry me a lot if I were to get on an airplane that had been certified by a group of people and not an ISO or standards-based viewpoint. It's very scary to have, and I'm just going to say it like this, mob rules almost. Because I don't, IETF, ISO have been around for a long time. Why would you want to not assert that in the first position?
I'm sorry, I guess I'm missing your point. I'm talking about IT standards only because all of the other kind of standards is in a different part of DoD, the mechanics and engineering and all that kind of thing. We have, as the DoD executive agent for IT standards, we have the IT standards program. We have the DISR, the DoD Information Technology Standards Registry, in which we place standards that are mandated for use throughout DoD. we had the hierarchy that we created some time ago that we mentioned. Now, recently, in recognition that standards coming from IETF, from OASIS, some of the recommendations from W3C, those are now being put into the DISR. We're now coming up to speed with the rest of the world, I guess you might say. Yes, it takes a long time for us to do that, but we are recognizing that. These are now considered equivalent to the accredited standards that you get from ISO or from ANSI.
Maybe Michael, a dangerous path, first, but that's it.
I just want to thank Bill for giving us a terrific From in the Trenches report. You know, that's just really fantastic. I'd also like to report an alternate contrasting experience. In my short time with Semantic Arts, we have contracts now with two large companies. The first one, there was a woman inside the company who just kind of got her bee in her bonnet about ontology. She's kind of like us, and she said, you know, this is the right stuff. And for a year or two or three, she pounded on people's heads. Someone who doesn't have a lot of control or influence, but she finally caught the ears of people. And then one day, you know, we got a contract, and now they're building a big enterprise ontology across the company. And more recently, we got contacted by a healthcare company. They said, you know what? We see that there's something going on here. I'm going to take your class. So they came and took the class. You know, kind of a business guy, not a technical guy, but he just wanted to understand what was going on. They're leading edge. They say, we want to be the first healthcare company on the block who's doing semantic tech. So there are people out there. You don't have to hide from the O word all of the time. And as Bill says, some of the time you do. And one of the big challenges is when.
We don't all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I'll make a comment. I think we, in fact, need to use the O word. I think if we allow others to preempt our definition, then we've ceded something that's technically sound to others who are not technically sound. And we've seen this in IT through time, right? That there's a word that becomes a buzzword, but underneath it's really technically sound. And we just got to make sure that that's understood and distinguish the things that are not ontology. If everything is ontology, like everything is agent technology, then Java is an agent, is agent technology. And, you know, XML schema is ontology. It's not true. Yes.
So to me, this issue comes right to the heart of this conference, right? If we're making the case for ontologies, one of the things we need to do, and Bill spoke to this very well, is we need to position what we're doing accordingly. Some audiences, you don't want to throw the word ontology out because, to Bill's example, they don't understand it, they'll pretend they do and get pissed off. Mm-hmm. Or there'll be some BA in philosophy who read Heidegger once who thinks they know what it means, and all sorts of bad things happen. You need to use the word, you're right, Leo, but you need to use it at the right time. And you need to tie it to the business problem at hand. If you can do that without introducing the term too early, more power to you. If the audience is receptive, then by all means do so. But be aware of the business context. That is absolutely key.
I agree. Mm.
Corey?
So, we've also faced the terminology word wars problem. There's ontologies. We face it with architecture, which is very much part of our business area of expertise, and that's a lot less feared than ontology. But you need a brand. You can say we're going to use it in the right context. That's fine. But I mean, if you go back to yesterday where you're afraid to put a definition of ontology in your paper, okay?
I don't think we're afraid. We just don't want to open the can of worms again and again.
Put my little blurb up, like, you know, why do you like this stuff? Right? Peter said, why didn't you use the word ontology in there? You got to go edit it, put ontology in there. You just said semantic technologies. I found that to be a little less objectionable. But my point is that this community, if it's going to define itself and make itself relevant in the mainstream, has to have a brand. And if you can't say ontology openly, and I don't think you can, You have to figure out something that works, and you have to stand behind it, and you have to brand it, and you have to sell it. I've been using semantic technology, and that's what Dennis used. It's a little bit safer.
Because it's wider.
It's wider. And the other thing is the thing that's happening in the linked open data world is such an opportunity. And, you know, say, but they're owned by the owl guys. No, they're not.
No.
They're at war with each other. Take advantage of that. You could provide the logical basis for linked open data, right? I said that to John once. I said, oh, practically shot me, right? Because, oh, it's ugly and it's not the right thing. Yeah, but it's happening. So we have to grab onto something that's happening, and putting all of your data on the web in a ways that connect is a concept people can get. And we have to be able to brand it in something that we can agree on, that we can put forth as a solution that won't scare them.
Yeah, I think that the linked data movement, it's actually the structural web that preceded the semantic web. So we've gone backwards after going forwards. But, you know, it's required to have structure exposed. Yes.
Hi. Our experience in the financial industry with, like, real business users trying to tackle problems through standards, finding XML wasn't the thing and UML wasn't the thing, was the word they kept coming back and using of their own volition was semantics. Now, as one or two people like me have been talking about ontology without any reference to OWL or any other notation, but saying, yes, you need an ontology. So people even started using and or tolerating the O word. But semantics is where they came in, because that's the problem. They own the problem of semantics. An ontology happens to be a tool in your arsenal of fixing the problem of semantics. Although I have to say, I think they would find it a bit disturbing that in a world that deals with defining things and having a clear idea of the meaning of something, that if we haven't got a meaning of ontology, we probably shouldn't be too surprised if people run off with it and do bad things with it. But that's just my thought.
Yeah, I do think we have definitions. But what we wanted to preclude was rehashing the whole discussion again and again. Yeah, if somebody will give me the URL, because I can't go pecking here. And I mean, we've actually had, you know, semantic technologies as the wider spectrum, if you will. We had an ontology summit that addressed, in fact, that spectrum. And, you know, what we did was try to position what you mean by an ontology and what are some of the properties associated with that, and then, therefore, to define what an ontology is. So multiple communities, that's always the issue, right? So library science, you know, Clay Shirky thinks ontologies were invented, you know, by the library scientists at the tail end of the 19th century. We know that it goes back, you know, to at least Aristotle. And you just need to make sure that the communities, that they, when they come together, they exchange the information they have and their perspectives, and they can converge. Okay, maybe two more questions, and then we'll move to a different panelist here. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Jim Disbrow, and about
here.
6 or 8 years ago, I was working for the government, and I got my boss to put into my performance standard an element that included something that I got from one of these conferences that referred to not just innovation, but to increasing the rate of innovation. Ah, yes, finally I knew what I was doing. I was increasing, and then ontologies came on the scene, and I was able to get into that same element, the word ontologies. She retires, a replacement comes in, doesn't have a clue what either of those mean, and after we get through negotiating over what I'm supposed to be doing, she's willing to let me keep doing what I've been doing, except now it's called taxonomies with relationships. And I said, I can live with that. It's rather weak, rather, well, anyway, I'm sure you all have emotional reactions to that. But that was how I went through this process so that I was actually able to continue before I retired, you know, working on that.
Over here. There you go.
My dad used to say, it all depends how you hold your mouth. I'm Doug Skuse, a professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. I'm about to write a grant proposal to the Canadian government asking for several $100,000, okay? I'm going to put myself through this pain for 1 week. No pain, no gain. I want to ask everybody a question, and I'm going to ask for a vote. You're going to either vote yes or no, all right? Here's the question. Do I dare put the O word in this grant or not? It's for this kind of stuff. It's O stuff. There's no question about that. The question is that O word going to help me or hurt me? How many think it will help me? The Canadian government, it'll be reviewed by academics and industry people who supposedly know what they're doing. Of course, they really don't. No, not the Parliament. The National Sciences... The NSERC, the National Science and Engineering Research Council, that funds most of this stuff, okay? They fund academic research, but they favor stuff that has ties to industry. So I will have a tie to industry. Okay. Okay. Question or are you answering?
Question.
Yes. I want to vote now. How many think I should put the O word in?
We wanted to get the grant.
Yeah, I want to get the grant. Okay, how many think I should put it in? Can I see that again? In? All right. How many think I should leave it out?
No.
Well, that's interesting.
No.
So
okay.
There are more in supporters than out supporters.
Right. But, qualify. I'd like to add a qualification. The qualification is where do you put it in? And the point that I would make is that you put the word ontology in, but not in the title, and you emphasize the word term. And you emphasize the word terminology, and you talk about terminology and ontology management.
Don't cede your ground. I mean, if you have a technical... Yeah, well... we're going to move on to Michael Gruninger.
One quick little implication. One of the terms of art that's coming up when people who have a subject matter expertise are trying to work on, you know, problems that ultimately are about ontology, they're starting to use the phrase practical semantics. And that may be another kind of phrasing that
Michael.
Okay, just to start off, I do have an NSERC grant with ontologies in the title, so so it worked.
It worked.
You have to mention you're from Canada.
University of Toronto in Canada, and I did get a grant with ontologies in the title. I have a few.
We'd like to second that. The Intelligier Foundation, actually, this whole thing is being sponsored with a grant that had ontology in the title.
There we go. So I put a few slides together just to hang my comments on. And we're just looking here at slide two. And one of the great things about this summit has been the excellent collection and synthesis of all the different use cases from the tracks to look at how ontologies are actually being used. But I wanted to maybe say a few comments about how can ontologies be used. This might have been in the directions of the grand challenges, but maybe these aren't grand challenges, this is maybe more challenges. So on slide three, I just wanted to pick one of them, which was semantic integration. So this is one of the slides, say, from the framework. So we're looking at things like information integration, and on the web, I mean, particularly web service composition and mashups, I think are one kind of application that Mills mentioned yesterday. That one of the challenges with semantic integration is maybe not the traditional let's get teams together to do mappings of applications, but more on the fly kinds of semantic integration. So the dream here really being kind of the seamless exchange of information in a very dynamic sort of way. So on slide four, my intelligent agent Leo will be So on slide four, I just wanted to pick up one of the phrases that Sita Farani mentioned yesterday, and that Ram Sriram also mentioned, that the idea of being network-centric sorts of computing, or as Sita mentioned, proactive computing, right, where we want to have information systems that really, you know, act in anticipation of future problems or changes. We want to be able to have systems that predict kind of future possible behaviors, analyzing data and events in real time, and have really intelligent objects, smart objects, right? I mean, this is IBM's latest phrase, right? Smart objects for a smarter planet. And on slide five, just mention, this was a project that we did with SAP, particularly Paul Hoffman and Harold Wepner at SAP Research in Palo Alto, where what we had was, we used radio frequency identifier chips, RFID tags, putting onto kind of work in progress in a factory, in a supply chain. And the idea was to make these objects be smart objects, so they could be self-directing through the different kinds of processes within a factory. So that at different points within the process, you'd have RFID readers, which had access to theorem provers. And they could answer queries like, well, which activities, you know, must occur next? If I can possibly make widgets or gadgets today, what do I need to do next to make a widget today? What kinds of things must I do next? What can I possibly defer and wait for? And so what we did was we actually took the SAP ERP model, wrote translators from that into ontologies. We took IDEF3, we took UML activity diagrams, and kind of was able to reuse different process plans, different business processes for this. And we used the process specification language, a first-order ontology written in Common Logic that was spearheaded here at NIST. And we're able to kind of do queries in kind of real time for these sorts of ideas. Now, this was a couple of years ago, and since then, I've had a student, instead of using RFID tags, we're using smart codes. You know, there's 2D barcodes that you see everywhere now. And so we put together a little iPhone app where what the app is able to do is to read a 2D barcode. And that 2D barcode encodes information about URLs for different common logic ontologies, and other kinds of specific instance information about whatever product the barcode is on. And it's able to aggregate the different common logic axioms of all these ontologies, translate it into a theorem prover notation called prover 9, and then automatically answer queries like, am I late? Where do I need to be sent next if today is a Tuesday sort of idea? And comes back, you know, sends a little web service, sends a query to a web service, runs the query, answer comes back. So this is sort of a kind of a pilot implementation for initial steps towards proactive computing using common logic kinds of ontologies. So just on the last slide, thank you, Leo. I want to actually use the E word, expressive. And I just want to make a few comments kind of along these directions. So if we're kind of looking in the direction of where can ontologies be used, what we want to be able to have is, I'm kind of emphasizing maybe some of the more decision support kinds of applications that I mentioned, say, in the framework yesterday, where we want to have answer kind of in dynamic, real time, a lot of these sorts of queries. Either related to product management or other kinds of operational sorts of queries. And so what do we need to do? What's the bottleneck here? Well, on the one hand, we really need some high-quality, shareable, and reusable ontologies. I think what we really want to have is, if we want to make the business case for ontologies, I think one of the things we have to have in place is a lot of infrastructure. Just as 100 years ago, rail lines were the infrastructure that had to be in place for economies to grow. And, you know, in the past 20 years, Ethernet cables, fiber optic cables are the infrastructure that business needed to grow. We need to have ontological infrastructure in place for business to grow. And you can't ask one business or another to build that infrastructure. That's something that kind of, I think we need to have a more collective effort. And part of that infrastructure is to have, again, high quality ontologies, but ontologies that are also shareable and reusable. So Now, partly this is going to raise some IP issues, intellectual property issues, and Ontolog has dedicated some discussions towards that. But that's going to be an issue that we need to face. So if these ontologies are going to be shareable, right, how do we make it so that all businesses can kind of share from this common pool, but at the same time tailor it towards their specific needs? That's going to be, I think that's going to be a big issue that we need to address. Along the lines of expressivity, to kind of answer a question like which is the right kind of language to use, which is the right ontology to use, there's two answers to that. On the mathematical logic answer is these aren't open questions. The relationships between all the various ontology languages is well understood. And that's kind of in place. And I actually, in the ontology courses I teach, I have students building ontologies for a particular domain, but in each of the different languages, RDF, OWL, rules, common logic, and they actually have to identify which concepts could they not say in one language, but which they could say in another. So they get some understanding of the limitations and the strengths of each language. And the thing would be, though, that the other answer of which language should I be using is an engineering issue. Because I think, as Mike Ushold mentioned earlier, too, there's also this, the tractability issue. I need to have answers back very quickly for a lot of these sorts of queries. And so the more expressive the language, typically the less efficient your reasoner is going to be. And so what we want to try to understand then is, what do we do in this when we face this challenge? So the second bullet I have here is, well, we need to have more efficient reasoners for these more expressive languages. That's one thing. But the other thing that we also need to be very careful about is when we make these trade-offs. So when we use maybe a less expressive language for a problem that maybe requires more expressiveness, what we often do is pragmatically we say, well, we'll answer part of this query in this language, but we'll also have some extra logical software that can help things along. We'll have special purpose algorithms that can help things along. And that's necessary to actually get an implementation to work. And as we can see that in a lot of the use cases that have been synthesized as part of effort today. But that's one place where we actually have to watch, because that can be our Achilles heel. Because as more of this gets expressed into software that's outside of a particular ontology or a particular ontology's language, those are potential barriers towards shareability. Those are potential barriers to reuse. And so that'll be one thing that we'll want to keep an eye on in different kinds of implementations going forward, is to really kind of be honest about what that line is. Because one of the things I'm kind of constantly worried about is kind of growing up during the AI winter is overselling. And to be able to make guarantees about what we can do with qualifications and what we cannot do. And so I think things like proactive computing are a great arena to be able to say, here are the things that we can do with qualifications, but with a clear idea of where we can go in the future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, a couple questions, Mills and Michael.
I'd like to offer up just a couple comments, just as amplification. I think the sorts of problem that you outlined for proactive computing, we already have examples, like in our cases, of it being done one-off and done, to the nine, mission critical. We had Chuck Rayburg, give his presentation on custom manufacturing of trucks and so on. And also in the area of high performance, high expressivity, we're talking about a rule base of 600,000 rules, a lot of concatenation, 23, kind of things, a lot of pre-compiling, a lot of ability to do temporal sequencing and so on, but much faster than Ops 5. And so such, kind of technology exists. And that was one thing. And then the second thing you kind of talked about was, but we also want this to be reusable and open. And there's sort of two thoughts that came to my mind there. One was that, when the pain in an industry across a segment or something is significant, then the supply chain will get together and solve. I'll give you an example. in the printing industries, when TVs went color, magazines were in black and white. In order to compete, they had to do color. In order to do color and have a consistent offering for advertisers, you know, they had to come up with how in the world did we do consistent color with pieces of film coming in from all over. And so they developed, you know, this sort of specifications for web offset printing, and there was a digital iteration later. But the point was that, you know, they were in a problem where, you know, their the lifeblood not only of it was a whole ecosystem of players who were living on that living in that trough. So in one sense, you know, in the verticals, you know, in other words, this condition about sharing kind of comes about. We see it in the libraries too. You know, they now look at, if we can use these semantics to connect things up, you know, then there are other benefits way over and above everything we've already put into our stuff. In the wild, or in a more general sense, I think the direction you're talking about is going to happen anyway. Is already starting to happen, and I've been starting to see the blog posts emerge now for Apple Siri OS. Which is to take an environment which is about, you know, combining natural language recognition, task knowledge, the ability to integrate A, information, and B, services, combine services into molecules. And I would argue that, for example, the implications of smartphone, tablet, the whole ecosystem of mobility, it basically forces the issue of needing to move in this direction such that the challenge becomes, you know, what ecosystem, you know, like all the developers, you know, does it become easiest to do? And since, you know, the ontology does require community agreements, it's probably, you know, Apple will continue to have an advantage in that space simply because they're more of a garden, you know, than say what's happening with Android and the others right now. But I think there are forces at work, you know, that actually, you know, are right in line with your thesis. That's my thoughts.
Michael?
So, Michael, nice, many good thoughts there. The one thing that came to mind that's very, very important is this business of IP for ontologies. And I have not given a lot of thought to this, but it's something that somebody needs to be giving a lot of thought to fairly soon. And the example that comes to mind that I'd like to see an analogy for, if we can make one, is you don't want, you know, everybody to have their own way of putting the brake pedal in the recent patenting those. So ideally, we all know in this room that we want to have ontologies be public resources rather than have everybody have private ones. And I don't know whether that means public funding of them. Pat Cassidy years ago had this idea to have a huge funded project to build an ontology. Maybe we need to do something along those lines.
Just a comment that the OOR addressed that intellectual property issues over quite a few sessions. So we had folks that were involved in patent and copyright issues with different organizations. And if you look at the OOR, and I don't have the reference right now, but we're taking an extremely open view. There's a number of licenses and models that define what open are, and we're trying to make it as open as conceivably possible. Okay, John, maybe.
I just want to make a very short comment, and that is that there will be the post-symposium discussion, which will include the Open Ontology Repository, the OOR, together with FactGuru, and together with discussions about how all these things could be integrated. And I think that the FactGuru technology is one aspect that can bring the terminologies and the ontologies together, but then you also need the management structure and everything else, and all of these things we'll discuss later.
Let's have two more questions, and then we'll have Nicola's, and then we'll have another session for asking questions. Here and then here.
Okay, I'll be very quick. So at the EDM Council, we needed to define, we needed to refer to common terms in things like law and accounting and so on. And the approach we took was one day each of those areas will have an industry standard that owns it. So rather than, ontologies being created by ontologists in isolation, we should help the standards bodies to mature to the point where their latest batch of XML or UML-based standards gets evolved into ontologies, which will, by definition, be public domain, because those are standards bodies. So the IP issue shouldn't be an issue. What will be is tying it in with the OOR and the terminology, which will help that exercise a lot.
Just to correct a few statements of law, it's settled law in the United States, and I believe it's settled internationally, in that given that the WIPO themselves believes that they have to grant permission to use their taxonomy and classification system for trademarks, and that they are the treaty body that negotiates the international law, it's very clear that the experts believe that it's copyright, and it's settled law. I believe it's the cases American Dental Association versus Delta Dental, Seventh Circuit, in an opinion written by Easterbrook, where he very clearly explains that the taxonomy that Delta Dental, that the ADA created, that Delta Dental were using was not mere facts and was copyrightable. And since copyright protection is in many ways more extensive than patent protection, patents don't enter into it. And also, just because something is an international standard does not take it out of the realm of copyright, as anybody who has tried to access, say, for example, a BSI standard, British Standards Industry standard, which at a charge of approximately 200 times the cost per page of the latest Harry Potter, will understand.
Yeah, we agree. And during our OOR IPR sessions, we covered a lot of this ground. So we had different legal perspectives that went into that conversation. And, we can provide the URL for the trace of that. It was very many discussions, many sessions addressing this. Okay. What I'd like to do, Nicola, if you would like to continue, then.
So let me start with the question emerged today from the audience concerning the possible need of an ontology of expressivity. And indeed, we already have such a thing. Indeed, I believe it is a major scientific result of computer science in the latest maybe 20 years, 15 years or so. We know everything about all the various different compromises between expressivity and computational tractability. We know very well the difference between a propositional logic and a first-order logic and so on. So we already have a lot, and this is indeed, to me, the main scientific advantage of description logic, the main scientific results. They helped us to understand this trade-off between expressivity and computational tractability. So, fine. And so basically the bottom line is that we know that if we want to have fast, scalable inferences, then we need to use a relatively poor language. No way, okay? But still, the challenge or possibly the mission, in my opinion, for ontologies nowadays, it goes exactly in the direction John Thowa pointed out, filling the gap between the things we can do at the information level, information technology level, and the needs at the business level. This gap between the business level and the information technology level is still there. European Commission has invested tons of euro in projects exactly addressing this problem. Okay, they managed to convince the founders to give them money in order to address this problem. The problem is still there. Now, for instance, working on services recently, it was a kind of discovery to me that there are very simple things you cannot say For instance, distinguishing a single man service from a multi-man service. Okay, you say there is a service whose provider is also the executor of the action. Okay, the provider is also the one who does the things for you. On one hand, this is the single man business. The multi-man business require there is some kind of delegation mechanism. Now, expressing these things in description logic is impossible just because they don't have variables. No way. Now, so expressivity is important, but it is not just a matter of expressivity. We also need proper languages at the ontological level, not just at the logical level. Just to make an example, 35 years ago, Bill Hoods wrote a paper, What is in a link? Many of us will remember it. Fundamental paper. And the paper was about, the point was that not all links are the same. Now, all links are the same. So Bill Hoods was saying, we can't just play with labels of links. Now, RDF people just play with labels of links. All links are the same. There is this basic RDF structure which is flat, completely flat. And this was exactly what Bill Hoods was pointing at 35 years ago as a problem. We are still there. Of course, there are solutions proposed, but still, by and large, we are still, in a sense, forced in this logical cage where you can't, which, let's say, doesn't help us to really be able to talk to people the language they want to talk. And this is where properly ontology comes into play. Formal ontology is complementary to formal logic. So we need to add something else on top on logic, understanding, studying the reality and so on and so forth. So this is our business. Now, this is the technical stuff, just a technical comment. Now, let me take this opportunity to address what is, for me, let's say, my favorite grand challenge for ontology in this context. let's say, 15 years ago, more or less, I was, among others, insisting on the fact that we need to endow information systems with ontology. There was this vision of ontology-driven information systems. I believe that the challenge now is to move from ontology-driven information systems to ontology-driven socio-technical systems. So the ontology is not just attached to the database, to the information system, to the technology machinery, but the ontology helps you to understand more wide-scale phenomena. This is the challenge to me. For instance, George Strong was pointing at the fact that the government now likes these dashboards stuff. Okay, imagine a dashboard which is a way to control a large, complex system, a dashboard which is driven by this ontology. Then the ontology accounts for a variety of, helps understanding a variety of phenomena and a variety of things, and helps in particular mediating about different terminologies and so on and so forth. So the vision I have is let's say, instead of open data, okay, just data which are there just to be used by people, open systems, so the systems account for their own machinery, for their own internal details and so on and so forth, by means of ontologies. And if we go this view, then we have to understand that the internal dynamics of these systems, there are people, there are organizations, there are machines, and there are laws, there are norms invented by people in order to make all these things together. And this is, to me, a challenge for the ontologies, trying to model these things, these complex systems, in order to open them to people. By opening them to people, the goal from the social point of view is to make these systems resilient to changes, resilient to failures, crises, and so on. So if the systems are open, then people can understand them when a crisis comes out and, try to cope with the crisis. This is the kind of vision I have in mind, which, by the way, is being discussed right now in a major future, in a so-called flagship proposal for the European Commission. The European Commission is now, last year, launched a couple of calls for big 10 years research projects. And there is a project which is called Future ICT, which ranked first in the first selection. Still, the final word hasn't been said. And basically, just to make it short, the goal of this flagship project is to have some kind of global Earth simulator. Okay, have a kind of mega dashboard for the whole Earth, so to speak, very visionary. In order to deal with this, understands what's happening and try to control things. A final word on the technical, on the challenge side. In order to deal with these dashboards, we need to put together ontologies and computational models on one hand, with mathematical models, simulation models on the other. For instance, weather forecasting systems, all these kind of things. And this is already also a big challenge, putting together mathematical models with ontologies, using ontologies to understand, to make clear what the meaning of a variable inside an equation is. Okay, this is just to throw something into the audience concerning a possible challenge. Let me say a few things concerning the old world. Yes, it is a little bit broken, it is. And unfortunately, we have to look at the history. While people were deliberately using this word to sell smoke, okay, and many people made money just selling smoke and rely on the fact that this ontology word was, ambiguous enough, okay? Various silver bullets throwing out. Anyway, and at that time, we as a community were wasting time fighting each other. And I still remember, still it is a pain in my neck, this Heidelberg event, and some of us, Bill was there, John was there, Doug was there, and maybe somebody else. Okay, it was a huge opportunity, and we missed it because we fighted each other. Okay, there were this kind of religious war. Now the good news, a lot of time passed since then. The good news is, I believe that, and indeed this event shows us that we are not fighting anymore. We learned how to behave properly, so to speak, to respect one each other. And of course, we have different opinions, for instance, concerning 3D versus 4D. Where is Matthew? And of course, we have different opinions, but we really respect each other and we understand each other, more or less.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think we should rely on this as a community and keep confidence and maybe it took a while, but we are in the right as we said indeed in the communique. Times are ripe and for ontology to go prime. How is it called?
Prime time.
So. A final word, a final word concerning simplicity. Okay, here is a point where maybe I disagree a little bit with John. Okay, because John insists on making things simple in order to convey the proper message to the ICT. Well, for instance, something I remember while talking with Matthew yesterday, he was insisting on the fact that there are no shortcuts. Okay, and we must buy the bullet. Some things do have some kind of complexity. We shouldn't be, forced too much by. We shouldn't simplify things more than they need, And the kind of stuff we are dealing with is complex, so we must bite the bullet and don't make compromise for the sake of getting easy results. Of course, this is also a discussion we emerged yesterday. Of course, there are low hanging fruits. Let's take them, fine. But it is very important to be aware of the trade-off between the investment and the potential results. When we scale from, long-hanging fruits to something much more interesting. Anyway, that's it.
Okay, thank you. Amanda?
Nicola, I want to amplify, actually, something you just said. Not only do we want to be clear on what's going to happen when we scale from the low-hanging fruit to the more ambitious or complex tasks. I think tying that back to the summit theme of making the case, it's exactly the failure to do that has made it so much harder today to make the case. It's and it's not always because people are being dishonest. It's sometimes because they don't understand. But the necessity of knowing what you get for what investment in the right infrastructure, the right expressivity, the right effort, and whether or not you'll be able to build from there to something more ambitious, or whether you'll be able to integrate and reuse from there in new projects. Understanding that is a step that's missing in a lot of the current efforts where people think, oh, well, yes, let's get the foot in the door. But they're not thinking about whether the work they're doing now will then have to be entirely thrown away at the next step. Disappointing the customer, if they're telling the customer it will build, and it won't. So.
I have a question regarding your idea to split. We have the simple English, which lots of people using, and we have linguistics as a science, which provide a lot of theoretical level. So my idea, I follow your idea, just want to make sure that I understand you clearly, that we should establish top level, like university discipline, a theoretical ontology for ontologists that should be sort of math or logics, which are theorems, that's degrees, everything, with a very high level of understanding and concepts, and which would understand the domain of business ontologies, just simple language for businesses. And if we will understand that we have two ontologists community, one of the ontology scientists who understand top level sort of math, theoretical ontology, and the level of using ontology language, like lots of people using English, even me, but lots of scientists research English language to provide people the better tool to use English grammar, whatever, to communicate and use the language. Is it correct what Nicola tried to provide us?
Microphone.
I'm not really advocating, let's say, this kind of separation you say between, you know, ontology scientists, so to speak, and ontology practitioners. I'm not. And also, altogether, the kind of concepts, properly ontological concepts you need, which belong to this, you know, scientific aspect, are not much more complicated to grasp than, let's say, differential equations or, you know, the things we studied. So it is complicated, but it is not terribly complicated. If you did electronics, you can perfectly do a course on formal ontology. Yeah. So it is not, it is just a piece of science with, for instance, the notion, understanding what does it mean to be part of something, just to make a technical example, okay, is something you can teach at school, at primary school. People don't, should be taught together with set theory, okay? They don't, but it is just a matter of, so I'm not advocating, you know, relegating high, fancy, you know, ontological science to a small group of people.
Thanks. But anyway, it's my proposition to keep in mind that probably it would be the solution to jump over the gap. So we, if it, it's my point now. Mm. If we say clearly that that is why we can't bring it together effectively, that is because we can't see really ontology as a science, and as something which has a subject, own language, top level, and that it would work like math works for the practice.
Right here.
Physics for electronics.
Okay. Yeah, I think if you hit it.
Thank you for addressing the expressivity question. And Matthew was kind enough earlier to explain the portability of the data between the different languages, which was actually the answer to my question, so which wasn't clear based on the discussion that was happening at that time. But I wanted to follow up on your comment about that flagship project, because frankly, the company I'm representing, the reason I'm here, is called Aurora Earth. And we are seeking to model consciousness, conscious experience vis-a-vis geospatial data and creative ability. So if you, did I hear what you were talking about? And when you talked about that flagship project, is that the kind of track you're on with that, or?
No, not so much. Well, there are many things into that. It is basically massive data mining, so-called reality mining, mm-hmm. in order to get data from reality, from the planet, let's say, and be able to do some kind of sophisticated analytics of this data, possibly using ontologies.
With any
and
predictive
so on.
Capabilities?
Yes.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Maybe we can talk offline after.
Yes, you can easily mine the web for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Mills and then Michael.
Okay. First of all, anyone who can say that the science and engineering of meaning-based systems can best be sold by content-free logos, I think is, you know, worth my my hat is off to you, sir. And Nicola, for the to get to systems that, you know learn, reason like people, you know, deal. I mean, anyone who says techno-social, economic coevolution of things is, my kind of guy too. But my question is, you started to allude to, harvesting information, reality browsing, things like this. But all of these imply a very rich strategy for learning, and learning that can be facilitated with ontology, but is hardly confined to it. You'll use every trick in the book to try to, deal with that. So what can you elaborate more on that dimension of what you're talking about?
Yes, but I'm not an expert on that. This project puts together a physicist's expert in complexity theory, people expert in data mining, people expert in sociological systems. It's a very large effort. For sure, there are problems related to this learning stuff. I don't know anything about that.
Michael?
I just want to address a point Mike Bennett made and Simon kind of also raised. I didn't really want to over legalize the shareability issue, but one question I'd like to ask, though, would be in the use cases, out of all the use cases, how many of the participants that provided the use cases would also be willing to provide the ontologies that they used, right? Because so to be able to kind of say, well, if they say we're using ontologies to do X, would they actually say, okay, here is the ontology that we used or the set of ontologies that we used, so then we'd be able to share them, maybe even combine with some of the other work with the Open Ontology Repository to collect them?
I think in the use cases as a whole, a lot of them, I don't think they even said necessarily what language the ontology was represented in, let alone the content. We had some use cases, my own stuff with the EDM Council, Sally May was also using our ontology. That's open, it's obviously copyright automatically exists with the creator, and as the creator, we've made that open source attribution, we've got to formalize the exact license. There were some others, I think, that were, yes, the...
I can name two that there's no way you're going to get. One would be the manufacturing process used for custom truck manufacturing. Those are the crown jewels of the company. That's mission critical. Forget about it. The second one would be probably you'll never see the light of day on the Amdocs case, which is the one that Franz reported, because that's a proprietary product offering, and unless you get in the queue for that. So those are, those are things. We have a whole litany of people who have done absolutely massively terrific things, as proprietary, approaches. To get to the next stage, some of the other cases were based on, things done by Cambridge Semantics, for example, which is really the pony's trick is, being able to expose what's in spreadsheets and in databases and build the fabric. You build your own, effectively. It's for subject matter users and business people to, build their own kind of connective tissue between, which has a whole bunch of things. And then there's an analytics platform, which again is roll your own kind of stuff. So there, the sharing of the ontology part is, possible. But the real reason for that is that the role of ontology in a work process was that it changed who did what and how fast they could get it done. And that's where the value proposition came from, as opposed to something about, the ontology per se.
Yeah, because this is one of my worries is this: there's this the paradox will be that we are promoting ontologies as shareable, reusable forms of representing knowledge,
but are
which
we?
Are never going
I,
to be shared and
that
used.
That's always the truth.
But,
I mean,
maybe it's kind of particularly the case with ontologies because we are kind of promoting them as being shareable and reusable. How do we kind of guarantee that? So that then, because otherwise, then we'll always be in the case where, in order to make the business case for ontologies, it's always going to be one-off developments, and then that's not going to be kind of playing to our strengths.
We have a comment over here first.
Okay, Nicola, as I understood you, you were claiming that fast scalable ontologies, you needed to use DL or some other limited tools. It seems to me that a more expressive language will make the same inferences equally fast. It's just a stronger tool will be able to make inferences that DL cannot make. And they may be able, depending on the circumstances, they can also be done quickly or in certain circumstances, no. But any inferences you can make in DL quickly can be made with a more powerful tool equally fast.
bill.
This is true. Yes, this is true. There is, in addition, you may want to have other inferences. And of course, there is this scalability problem. But by the way, in some cases, you don't need fast answers. Okay, for sure, you need fast answers on taxonomic reasoning. That's fine. This is good. This is where description logics are perfect. But in some cases, for some kind of deep reasoning, you can just relax. And the problem is understanding things. You can take a couple of days to understand the intricacies of a complex system, and once you properly formalize these things, the advantage is huge. So we have to, as indeed Michael said, we need to use the proper tools for the kind of things we need. In some cases, some kind of inference are need to be necessarily fast. Others, not necessarily so.
Todd, and then Matthew.
To the issue of the openness of ontologies, I'd suggest in the particular use cases that have been presented or studies, those were at the level of detail that they could actually execute them straight away, right? Well, no, I mean, in terms of technical detail, they had sufficient level of of detail in the representation that the systems could do something with them straight away. In order to, say, skirt around some of the IP issues and promote the reusability, what we probably have to aim for as a community is a level that's not sufficiently low, but not low enough that you're going to run into the IP issues. And this gets to some material Leo's written about ontological architecture. We need sort of a community architecture as to how far down from an upper ontology can you go, still make it sufficiently reusable, and then leave enough room for the particular companies to provide their own immature.
I think you want to also say you need to understand business. And you need to look at these things from...
No,
from,
but
from
I'm trying to get to the issue of reusability and sharing of ontologies.
Yeah, but business considerations trump, openness or anything else. I mean, you're open about certain things because it makes sense. You're closed
about other
things.
So how open can you be and still have sharing and still allow for whomever to extend that to the level of detail that they need for their particular case?
Matthew?
Well, I'm going back about 10 minutes to what Michael was saying about sharing and
a little closer to the microphone.
And with the implication that sharing implies openness, and I just want to say that's not true. Sharing is a relative thing. It's about who you share with. And proprietary, you're still sharing, but in a closed environment rather than an open environment. Mm-hmm. And the value still comes from being a shared ontology amongst those whom it is shared. And in fact, the competitive advantage comes from not sharing it with other people who you're not sharing it with. So it's still about sharing. Just that there are some barriers around, and that can also be part of the value.
John?
Okay. I'd like to give the example of Amazon.com as a company that has established a universal ontology for selling almost anything from, they started with books, went to electronics and practically anything. And the point is that is a shared ontology among every company that sells stuff. Now, each company will have all sorts of proprietary things. When Apple sells an iPad through Amazon, they don't disclose the details of what's inside the iPad, but they do disclose the price, the name of it, and a lot of the external details that the customer wants to know, but they don't disclose everything. So that's an example where you can have a high-level shareable ontology for an interoperability at that level of sales businesses, but each company reserves the right to keep the details of their product secret.
And to extend on that, there's actually business value in having common ontology. An ontology at the level we're talking about here, we're not talking about some design solution, but a mapping of facts about the real world. So if you have common concepts about, bonds and derivatives and credit default swaps and things, then being able to extend that with proprietary stuff, is actually a to everybody's advantage to have those common terms that everybody agrees. It's like, you can go to London and make a map, and somebody else can go to London and make a map. And yes, there's a copyright on the way it's mapped, but London is no secret. So, it's building out from that to the interesting stuff. There's a business case. And I think that also comes back to how we partition it. There are industries like legal and accounting that we then specialize in terms like financial. So there's a structure to reality. It's not just a case of, sure, we have this industry and that industry.
Yeah.
So, for example, mortgage-backed security. So
you actually put it to test.
Yeah. So we took the semantics repository material and we looked at what it would take to create end-to-end linkages between a mortgage pool, a loan, and all the facts were available in their different stovepipe silos in Fannie Mae and the mortgage agencies and the banks and so on, and being able to connect all that together enables one to create applications which use the ontology as a way of bringing together all the terms that were otherwise just not connected, and therefore give you a better view of.
But there was also a business driver for that, in that it took huge amount of cost out of what is currently a very fragmented, everybody scrubbing and redoing the data over and over again in that value chain.
So
consequently, across that systemic application, there's both
Simon
sharing and
Michael
not.
Ashford.
Yeah, it's like a common R&D.
Just to echo and reflect on a few points, I've got one friend who's transferred for his second tour in the Marines. He's now transferred from aircraft to infantry, and I've got another friend who is currently an actual second lieutenant, which makes me feel almost like a pedophile, but. He's in ordnance school at Fort Lee, where both of these people are going to need to know a lot about CIED. And I would very, very much like if they knew about it and other people in the countries where they'll be visiting didn't know what they knew, and that the information was shared between the different agencies that know different bits about what happens where, and that it happens quickly enough that the information gets out to the people who need to know it before they become statistics. And
Michael, and then we have to break.
Okay. I just wanted to kind of expanding on what Mills was saying. A lot of these cases, you build ontologies in the company, it's part of your business, you wouldn't even think of giving it away. However, I believe that there are cases where it does make sense for a company to build a large ontology and give it away, and it becomes associated with them as the standard in industry. But I don't know enough about when or when not that makes sense, and I would love for someone who's passionate about it to make the case for opening up ontologies. When does it make sense to advise a client, you should open up this ontology, and the whole world will be following you, and there's some business value there.
Actually, more comment from Dennis.
Just three things. We have a mandatory sharing rule in cases where it makes sense. We just spend too much money using it. That's one reason why we're doing this. Secondly, every one of our projects has requirement to have multiple disciplined people, much like was said down here, including some who don't know how to do this, but they want to, and we're just allowing them to be on the boat and watch how it's run. And they end up contributing more than we ever would have expected in the beginning because their point of view is different. And then just the third thing, we have a seminar. I forgot to put that slide up, but it's in the deck. We have a seminar in July, last week in July, right after the Fosse show, that 2 years ago was all SOA. Last year was 25% semantic web and 75% SOA. This year it's going to be 75% semantic web and 25% SOA. So we're looking for papers. You can go on the BTA, the DCMA website, or maybe on the proceedings of this, and you'll see the seminar advertised there. So I got what I wanted out of this, really hearing all the wonderful ontologists talking about these things. Let's keep it going. Don't bury the word. There it is. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, folks. We're going to break now and return at 1:45 talk about the communique, have the communique presented. Thank you. Let's have an applause for all of our panelists.